in no place and no time. That's when you become simply an awareness in an infinite field of possibility. You're in the unknown, and from the unknown, all things are created. You're in the quantum field, and you and I already have all the biological machinery we need to accomplish this feat of becoming pure consciousness. Chapter 9. Three Stories of Personal Transformation. In this chapter, you'll meet a few folks who put the energy of their consciousness into the immaterial world beyond the senses, and repeatedly embraced a possibility until it materialized into their lives. Laurie's story. At age 19, Laurie was diagnosed with a rare degenerative bone disease called polyostotic fibrous dysplasia. In this debilitating condition, the body replaces normal bone with a cheaper, fibrous tissue, and the skeleton's supportive protein scaffolding becomes uncharacteristically thin and irregular. The atypical growth process associated with the syndrome causes bones to swell, weaken, and then fracture. Fibrous dysplasia can occur in any part of the skeleton, and in Laurie's body, it manifested in her right femur, right hip socket, right tibia, and some of the bones of her right foot. Her doctors told her the disease had no cure. Fibrous dysplasia is a genetic condition that usually doesn't manifest until adolescence. In Laurie's case, she spent a whole year limping painfully around her college campus with what turned out to be a femoral fracture before any sign of the disease surfaced. She was shocked to hear she'd broken a bone, because she hadn't suffered any trauma, other than one foot being anatomically larger than the other. Laurie hadn't seen any evidence that anything was wrong with her until that point. She had lived a relatively active youth filled with activities like running, dancing, and playing tennis. At the time she began limping, she'd even begun training as a competitive bodybuilder. After the diagnosis, Laurie's life changed overnight. Her orthopedic surgeon warned her that she was fragile and extremely vulnerable. He insisted that she walk only with crutches until he could schedule her for surgery, first a bone graft, followed by the insertion of a Russell Taylor femoral nail down the bone shaft. After hearing that news, both Laurie and her mother spent an hour crying in the hospital cafeteria. It was like some sort of nightmare. Laurie's life, as she knew it, seemed to be suddenly over. Laurie's perception of her limitations, both real and imagined, began to dominate her life. To avoid additional fractures, she followed the surgeon's orders and dutifully used the crutches. She had to quit the marketing internship she'd recently begun with a major Manhattan product manufacturer, and instead began filling her days with medical appointments. Her father insisted she see as many orthopedic specialists as possible, so her weeping mother drove Laurie from doctor's office to doctor's office over the next several weeks. Each time she saw a new doctor, Laurie would patiently wait for a different medical opinion, only to receive the same bad news again. In just a few months, 10 surgeons had weighed in on her condition. The last physician she saw did have a different opinion. He told Laurie that the surgery the other doctors had recommended absolutely wouldn't help her, because inserting the nail would strengthen the diseased bone only in the weakest location and would actually cause more fractures in the next most vulnerable area above or below the nail. He advised Laurie to forget about surgery and continue using crutches or a wheelchair, or simply become sedentary for the rest of her life. From then on, Laurie remained still most of the time for fear she might break a bone. She felt powerless, small and fragile, and she was filled with anxiety and self-pity. She did return to college a month later, but stayed largely cooped up in an apartment that she shared with five other women. She cultivated an impressive ability to cloak a severe and mounting clinical depression. Laurie's father had been a violent man for as long as she could remember. Even once his children were grown, each member of the family had to be prepared for the wrath of this man's quick-moving fists at the most unexpected of moments. Everyone was constantly in a state of vigilance, wondering when his temper would flare next. Although Laurie certainly didn't know it at the time, her father's behavior was intrinsically connected to her condition. Newborns spend the vast majority of their days in the delta brainwave state. During the first 12 years, children gradually progress to a theta state, and then to an alpha state, before they get to the beta state they'll spend most of their adulthood in. As you read earlier, theta and alpha are highly suggestible brainwave states. Young children don't yet have an analytical mind to edit or make sense of what happens to them. So all of the information they absorb from their experiences is encoded directly into their subconscious minds. Because of their increased suggestibility, the moment they feel emotionally altered from some experience, they pay attention to whoever or whatever caused it, and so are conditioned to form associative memories, connecting that cause to the emotion of the experience itself. If it's a parent, then over time, children will attach to that caregiver and think that the emotions they feel from the experience are normal, because they don't yet have the ability to analyze the situation. This is how early childhood experiences become subconscious states of being. Although Laurie didn't know this when her condition was diagnosed, the emotionally charged events she experienced growing up with her father had been branded into her implicit memory system beyond her conscious mind, programming her biology. Her reaction to her father's anger, feeling weak, powerless, vulnerable, stressed, and fearful every single day, then became part of her autonomic nervous system, so that her body chemically memorized these emotions, and the environment signaled the genes associated with her disorder to turn on. Because that response was autonomic, she wouldn't be able to change it as long as she stayed trapped in her emotional body. She could only analyze her state of being equal to the emotions of her past, even though the answers she needed existed beyond those emotions. Once Laurie received the fibrous dysplasia diagnosis, her mother immediately proclaimed to the entire family that Laurie had been officially pronounced fragile by modern medicine. So she was safe from her father's physical violence. Although he continued to emotionally and verbally abuse Laurie right up until his death 15 years later, her disease, ironically, protected her from further physical abuse. This perverse sense of safety that Laurie created became a vehicle of survival for her. As a result, she began to benefit from special treatment, which she almost always needed. Whether getting a seat on the bus or subway when there was standing room only, getting her friends to wait in line for events while she sat on a nearby bench, or getting a seat quickly in a crowded restaurant, Laurie found that her disease began to work for her. She started relying heavily on her ailment to get what she wanted. She was now able to manage better in a world that she'd never before viewed as safe. The emotional benefit of manipulating her reality to get what she wanted in this way became very convenient, and Laurie received far more than she really needed to take stress off her body to prevent injury. Before long, her disease became her identity. Laurie next developed a late adolescent rebellion against the life that she thought had been thrust upon her by her doctors, her parents, and fate. By the next semester, after her diagnosis, she went into a solid state of denial about her disease. She decided to become the first gimpy bodybuilder, returning to the sport with complete devotion. blindly obsessive while white-knuckling it and forcing a positive attitude, solely with her conscious mind, Laurie found creative ways to bear weight that wouldn't twist her limbs. She thought that by trying to push through the pain, she'd become healthier, although in truth her efforts backfired, because she felt awful most of the time, and her pain worsened. As sometimes happens with polyostotic fibrous dysplasia patients, Laurie also developed scoliosis and suffered from severe back pain daily. By the time she was in her 20s, she began to develop arthritis in her spine and elsewhere. After she graduated from college, despite shuttling herself between a new house and a new job, Laurie became very sedentary and felt even more removed from life. Her fear, anxiety, and depression remained. She envied most of her peers and lost friendships and romantic interests because she lived more like her elderly parents than like a young adult. By her late 20s, Laurie used a cane all the time to get around, even when she wasn't nursing one of the 12 serious fractures she'd eventually endure. As if those issues weren't enough, she also experienced dangerous microfractures. Her bones were so weak that bigger stress fractures would appear beneath the microscopic fissures and connect to other areas of weakened bone to form even bigger fractures that could be seen on an X-ray. By age 30, Laurie had more back problems than her 72-year-old father, and she essentially became old before her time. She rested in bed for days and missed so many weeks of work that she was forced to quit jobs. She put graduate school on hold because the school that accepted her didn't have a working elevator. She had to forego parties, museum outings, shopping, traveling, concerts, and other activities that would have involved a lot of standing or walking. She was caught in the thinking and feeling loop I talked about earlier, thinking that she was limited and fragile on the inside, while her body manifested limitedness and fragility on the outside. The more she felt vulnerable and weak, the more vulnerable and weak she became, while continuing to experience fractures that reinforced her belief that she was frail, and further reaffirming her identity and validating her state of being. She adjusted her diet and took various vitamins and supplements, in addition to bone-strengthening drugs, but nothing seemed to stop the fractures. She could fracture a bone just from walking up a flight of stairs or even stepping off a curb. It was like waiting for the next nightmare in a series. Ironically, when Laurie wasn't using crutches or limping, she looked perfectly healthy. Most people assumed that her cane was some sort of eccentric accessory, and many didn't believe Laurie really had a debilitating condition, which made it difficult and frustrating at times to receive the special treatment she often needed. Trying to convince people that she really had a disease further solidified her identity as a sick person, set her intention to prove she was handicapped, and anchored her belief about her disabled status. While the rest of the world seemed to work very hard to hide their weaknesses and vulnerabilities, Laurie found that she was constantly announcing hers. She spent a lot of energy trying to control as much as possible in her environment. She paid careful attention to everything she ate and drank, measuring everything she consumed. Every walk around her neighborhood was calculated. She even weighed how much she could carry home from the supermarket, 10 pounds, which was also the limit of the weight she could gain before her bones would worsen. It was exhausting, but it was all Laurie knew to do. Her range of options got narrower and narrower as she kept limiting the scope of things that she could do physically, in an attempt to keep from fracturing. As her lifestyle became narrower, her mind became narrower along with it. Laurie's fears increased, her depression worsened, and eventually she tried to work again, but couldn't even hold down a job. This same woman who'd once been a runner, dancer, and competitive bodybuilder was now limited to doing only yoga for fitness, and by her late 30s, even hatha yoga had come to be too much for her. For years, her exercise was limited to sitting in a chair and doing vigorous breathing, although in her early 40s, her doctor finally allowed her to take up lap swimming. She did make some attempts at healing through therapists, holistic doctors, energy healers, sound healers, and homeopaths, always seeking solutions outside of herself. A few times she'd feel better after an energy healing and go straight to the orthopedist and demand new x-rays, only to be deflated when the results came back unchanged. She thought maybe this is as good as it's ever going to get. She awoke overwhelmed each morning, overcome with a feeling of dread, convinced she couldn't handle whatever the world had in store for her. Laurie and I met in 2009, after she had seen What the Bleep Do We Know, and become transfixed by the concept that a person could possibly create a totally new life. I happened to meet her while eating dinner before a workshop. I was teaching at a retreat center near New York. We talked about the courses I gave on personal change, and she immediately registered for my next class that August. When Laurie came to her first event, she heard that it was absolutely possible to change your brain, your thoughts, your body, your emotional state, and your genetic expression. During the workshop, I talked about physical change, but Laurie's beliefs about her disease and her body were tenacious, and her emotions were stuck quite firmly in her past. She had absolutely no intention of healing her body, mostly because she didn't really believe it was even possible. She came because she just wanted to feel better on the inside. Laurie immediately applied the principles I taught as best she could, even though she couldn't seem to feel different by choice. The very first thing she did, almost immediately after that first weekend course, was to stop sharing her diagnosis with others. Even though she couldn't control her emotions, she figured that she still had control over what she said out loud. So unless she needed to ask for a chair at a party or explain to a date why she couldn't take a walk with him, she stopped acknowledging her condition altogether. Laurie chose to focus on where she was headed in her future, toward a happy inner self, a deep connection to some unknown divine source, a wonderful job that she excelled at, a life partner, and close and healthy relationships with friends and relatives. Laurie next concentrated on changing a few simple behaviors. She watched her thoughts and words and reminded herself repeatedly to stop her old, repetitive, destructive patterns. She kept doing the meditations and taking my courses. In order to assign meaning to what she was doing, she reread her class notes religiously and kept in touch with as many fellow students as she could. In time, some small but perceptible percentage of the day, Laurie felt better, taller, abler, and stronger. She'd say, "change," to herself 20 times a day, whenever she noticed her mind drifting to her past. Although negative thoughts sneak through 100 times a day, little by little, Laurie created a few new thoughts, wrote them down, and attempted to believe them deeply. Laurie worked hard at it, but it took almost 2 years before she could really feel those new thoughts. Instead of getting frustrated during that waiting period, Laurie reminded herself that it had taken quite a long time to create the disease from her emotional state, so it might take some time to uncreate it. She also reminded herself that she'd have to go through a biological, neurological, chemical, and genetic death of the old self before the new self emerged. The circumstances in her external environment got worse before they got better. A flood trashed Laurie's home, and other situations in her apartment building created some new health problems. Laurie told me that every time she'd sit down to do her meditation and rehearse her ideal life, she felt as if she were telling herself a lie. And afterward, opening her eyes to the current circumstances felt like a slap in the face. I encouraged her to stop defining reality with her senses and to keep crossing the river of change. Laurie kept limping into the workshops, grumpy at times and grateful at others, and she kept at the work. She also assembled as many local fellow students as she could to meditate together. Hardly any situations in Laurie's life were pleasing, so she thought, "What the hell? I may as well have 1 hour a day behind my own eyelids, where reality looks different, where I have a pain-free body, a safe and quiet home, and a full and loving relationship with the outside world and with my friends and family." In early 2012, during one of my progressive workshops, Laurie had a significant deepening in her meditation experience. She was literally and figuratively rocked to her core. Physically, it was like a disturbance and then a release. Her body shook, her face contorted, and her arms flew up as she tried her best to stay rooted to her chair. Emotionally, it was inexplicable joy. She cried, she laughed, and sounds came out of her mouth that she couldn't explain. All of the fear and control that she'd previously used to hold herself together was finally loosening. For the first time, she felt a divine presence and knew she was no longer alone. Laurie told me, "I sense something, someone, some divine presence, and this consciousness wasn't ignorant to my existence and unconcerned with my welfare, as I apparently previously believed. This consciousness has actually been paying attention. Realizing that was an overwhelming change for me." All the energy she'd been putting into controlling her physical movements and her life in general finally began to relax and unwind, and the energy she'd been using to maintain that control started to free up. At the next event, I noticed that Laurie was walking without a cane or any limp. She was happy, smiling and laughing to herself, instead of irritated, frowning and wincing in pain. She was transmuting fear into courage, frustration into patience, pain into joy, and weakness into strength. She was beginning to change, on the inside and the outside. Free from the addiction of those limiting emotions, her body was now living less in the past as she moved toward a new future. In early spring 2012, Laurie's orthopedist told her during a regular checkup that about two-thirds of the length of a fracture she'd had in her femur since she was 19, a fracture that had shown up on every one of the 100 or so x-rays she'd had so far, had vanished. He had no explanation to offer, but instead suggested she begin riding a stationary bicycle at the gym for 10 minutes twice a week. The message was music to Laurie's ears, and off she went. All of Laurie's work in crossing the river of change was now starting to pay off. She was finally getting feedback that let her know she was making some type of physical progress. Each day, as Laurie got beyond her body, her environment and time, she was also getting beyond the personality that was connected to her present and past external reality, beyond her emotionally addicted and habituated body, and beyond the predictable future that she'd always expected, based on her memory of the past. All of her effort to supersede her analytical mind, change her brainwaves to those of a more suggestible state, find the present moment, and venture into the programming system where she was emotionally altered earlier in her life, was finally changing her. Laurie started to really believe that her mind was healing her body by thought alone. And the old fracture that was connected to the old self was healing, because she was literally becoming someone else. She was no longer firing and wiring the circuits in her brain that were connected to the old personality, because she was no longer thinking and acting in the same ways. She stopped conditioning her body to the same mind by reliving her past with the same emotions. She was unmemorizing being her old self and remembering being a new self. That is, firing and wiring new thoughts and actions in her brain by changing her mind and emotionally teaching her body what her future self would feel like. Lori was signaling new genes in new ways during her daily meditation by simply changing her state of being. Those genes were making new proteins that were healing the proteins responsible for the fractures related to her dis-ease. From what she learned in the workshops, she reasoned that her bone cells needed to get the right signal from her mind in order to turn off the gene of fibrous dysplasia and turn on the gene for the production of a normal bone matrix. Lori explained, "I knew that over the years, all of those fractures had manifested structurally from the unhealthy protein expression in my bone cells, because I had been living by the survival emotions of fear, victimization, and pain, and I felt weak. I was powerful enough to manifest weakness perfectly in my body. I had programmed the genes to stay on because I'd memorized those emotions subconsciously in my body. And my body, as my mind, was always living in the past. So I figured if bones are made of collagen, which is a protein, and I wanted my bone cells to make some healthy collagen, I'd have to enter my autonomic nervous system, get beyond my analytical mind, enter into the subconscious mind, repeatedly reprogram my body with new information, and allow it to receive new orders every day. When I received the good news, I felt like I was halfway across the river of change." Lori kept her meditations going and continued to take my workshops. She continued to have times of physical pain, but the frequency, intensity, and duration decreased considerably. She changed as many things as she possibly could. She changed gyms just for a different environment. She put her deodorant on the right side first instead of the left. She folded her arms left over right instead of the more natural right over left whenever she could remember to do so. She sat in a different chair in her apartment. She slept on the other side of the bed, even though it meant walking all the way around to the far side of the room to get in and out of bed. She reported, "Ridiculous as that may sound, I was just intent on giving my body as many new and different signals as possible, and since moving to a big house in the Hamptons wasn't realistic, these tiny things would have to do." Lori even put notes everywhere in her environment to remind herself to stay conscious and to elicit thoughts and feelings about her future. She wrote, "I am grateful," "elevate," and "love" on painter's tape, and stuck the notes on the back of several doors. She stuck a sticky note on her dashboard that read, "Your thoughts are incredibly powerful. Choose yours wisely." Encouraging notes and affirmations weren't new to her, but she'd never had the capacity to believe them before, because she hadn't known how to change her beliefs. In late January 2013, when she saw her orthopedist again, he told her, for the first time in 28 years, that she had no evidence of fractures. None. Her bones were whole and undamaged. She wrote to me, "I cannot convey in words the joy this brought me. I now felt empowered and lifted. I know I am more than halfway across the river of change." Her bone cells were now programmed to make new, healthy proteins. Her autonomic nervous system was restoring balance within her body physically, chemically, and emotionally. It was doing the healing for her through a greater intelligence, and she knew she could trust and surrender more to it now. Her body was continuing to respond to a new mind. The month after her appointment with the orthopedist, Lori flew to Arizona for one of my advanced workshops. An hour after she arrived, she received a phone call from the doctor's assistant, who told her that the results from her blood and urine tests were back, and they indicated that her disease was actually still quite active. Her doctor recommended that she resume intravenous biophosphonate therapy for the first time in many years. Lori was heartbroken. The x-rays had left her with the impression that she was whole again, but the lab tests indicated otherwise. Within seconds, she had lost perspective and was certain she'd failed. When she told me the news, I reassured her that her body was still living in the past and just needed more time to catch up with her mind. I suggested she continue to do the work for a few more months and retake the urine test then. Inspired by some of the folks in our workshops who'd changed their health, Lori went home and did her practice in earnest, feeling more vividly and intensely in her meditations the life that she could have. She stopped imagining herself with healed bones, per se, and just imagined herself as whole, in general, vital, glowing, resilient, youthful, and in energetic good health. She mentally rehearsed and emotionally embraced having everything she wanted, which included a functional, walking body. She told herself that the old lady she'd been from ages 19 to 47 was just a story from the past. Over the next few months, Lori simply began to feel happier, more joyful, freer, and healthier. She began to think with more clarity about her future. She rarely felt pain in her body and walked without any assistance. When May 2013 arrived, she was feeling some trepidation about her appointment to retake the lab test. She postponed the appointment until June. Then Lori discussed her hesitation and anxiety with an experience workshop student, who asked her to think about some good things she could imagine related to walking into the hospital and taking the test. At this point, Lori realized she had lots of positive, life-giving emotional resources to draw on. She began reciting a long list, including how clean the hospital was, how helpful all the staff always were, what an easy place it was to go just to be taken care of. It was exactly the shift in focus she needed. On the day of the appointment, as she drove to the hospital, Lori gave thanks for the sunshine, for how well the traffic was moving, for her car, for her leg that was helping to operate the car, for her perfect eyesight, for the parking spot she easily found, and so on. As she later described to me, I went inside, gave them my name, shut my eyes, and meditated in the waiting room until it was my turn. I peed in a cup, handed the nurse the bag, and walked out, giving thanks for the simple act of walking. And I let go of the result, entirely. I was okay, deep down inside, with either outcome. It enabled me to forget about it entirely, because I wasn't expecting anything. I felt happy, in fact, obsessively grateful. I stopped analyzing and just trusted. She remembered my saying that the moment she began to analyze how or when her healing would happen, it would mean she was just returning back to the old self, because the new self would never think in that unsure way. Lori continued, and so, for no reason, I was simply grateful in the present moment, ahead of the actual experience. I wasn't waiting for the results to make me happy or thankful. I was in a state of authentic gratitude and in love with life, as if it had already happened. I no longer needed something outside of me to make me happy. I was already whole and happy because something inside of me was more whole and complete. She had almost nothing on any external grand scale by which to measure success, satisfaction, and security. Not income, a house, a partner, a business, a child, not even any recent volunteer work she was particularly proud of. But Lori had the love of her friends and those family members whom she could connect with. and she had a newfound love for herself. She'd realized that she'd never had self-love before, only self-interest. She told me later that it was a distinction that she never could have understood in her previous, narrow state of mind. She felt quite content with herself and her life. She said, "And for the first time since I began this journey, I just didn't care about the test. I was happy with myself." 2 joyful weeks later, the test results came back. The doctor's assistant told Lori, "Your results are perfectly normal. You scored a 40. Your values are down from an abnormal, elevated level of 68 just 5 months ago." Lori had crossed the river and was on the shores of a new life. There was no evidence of her past living in her body any longer. She was free, born anew. Lori told me later, "It occurred to me in an instant that my identity as patient and sick person with a disease had become stronger than any other role I'd played in my life. I had pretended to be that person, but all along I knew I wasn't. All of my attention and energy were consumed with being a patient, instead of being a woman, a girlfriend, a daughter, an employee, or even just a happy and whole person. I now know that I had no available energy to be anyone else, until I took my attention off the old personality, an old self, and reinvested my attention and energy into a new self. I'm so grateful that now I am me instead of that." Lori now has no regrets and no significant resentments, and she feels no loss over the past. As she puts it, "I wouldn't want to judge or hold a grudge or feel forsaken from my past, because that choice would take away this feeling of wholeness. It's as if my past condition was actually a blessing, because I overcame my own limitations, and now I'm in love with who I am. I'm at peace. I'm truly changed on the biological and cellular level. I am proof of the message that your mind can heal your body, and believe me, no one is more surprised than I am." Candace's story. Candace's relationship, barely a year old, just wasn't working. After their first few months together, she and her boyfriend became deeply embroiled in incessant fighting, volatile accusations, constant mistrust, and ceaseless acts of blame. They both felt jealous and insecure, so their communications were frustrating at best. They each were haunted by unfulfilled expectations that the other had no hope of satisfying. In a rage she'd never known, Candace found herself in violent screaming matches, throwing uncontrollable tantrums. These fits left her feeling more unworthy, more victimized, and more insecure. All of this behavior was new to her. She hadn't been an angry, frustrated, or upset person before, and she'd never thrown a tantrum in all of the 28 years of her life. Although she knew on a gut level that staying in those circumstances wasn't benefiting her, Candace couldn't escape the emotional attachment to this unhealthy relationship. Yet as she became addicted to her stressful emotions, this became her new identity. Her personal reality was creating her new personality. Candace's external environment was controlling how she was thinking, acting, and feeling. She had become a victim, trapped in her own life. Flooded with the strong energy of survival emotions, Candace began to operate like an addict, needing that emotional rush of feelings and believing that it was something out there that was causing her to feel and think and react in certain ways. She couldn't think or act greater than how she felt. Imprisoned in this emotional state, she was recreating the same thoughts, the same choices, the same behaviors, and the same experiences over and over again. Candace was actually using her boyfriend and all of the conditions in her outer world to reaffirm who she thought she was. Her need to feel anger, frustration, insecurity, unworthiness, fear, and victimization was associated with that relationship. Even though it wasn't serving her greatest ideal, she was too afraid of change to remedy the situation. In fact, she became so bonded to those emotions, because they reaffirmed her identity, that she would rather feel those familiar toxic feelings constantly than leave and embrace the unfamiliar, to step from the known into the unknown. Candace began to believe that she was her emotions, and as a result, she memorized a personality based on the past that she created. About 3 months after things began to really go downhill, Candace's body couldn't sustain the stress of that heightened emotional state, and her hair started falling out in very large chunks. Within weeks, almost a third of it was gone. She began experiencing severe migraines, chronic fatigue, gastrointestinal issues, poor concentration, insomnia, weight gain, consistent pain, and a myriad of other debilitating symptoms, all of them quietly destroying her. An intuitive young woman, Candace innately felt that this dis-ease was a self-inflicted product of her own emotional issues. Just thinking about her relationship would physiologically knock her out of balance in preparation for another conflict. Candace was turning on stress hormones and her autonomic nervous system by thought alone. And when she thought about her partner, or talked or complained about their relationship to her family and friends, she was conditioning her body to the mind of those emotions. It was the ultimate mind-body connection. And because she couldn't turn off the stress response, eventually she began down-regulating genes. Her thoughts were literally making her sick. 6 months into the relationship, Candace was still living in utter dysfunction, at the highest levels of stress. Even though she was sure by now that the symptoms in her body were a warning sign, she subconsciously continued to choose the same reality, which was now her normal state of being. Barraging her body with negative survival emotions, Candace was signaling the wrong genes in the wrong ways. She felt that she was slowly dying from the inside out, and she knew she needed to take control of her life, but had no idea how to go about doing it. She couldn't find the courage to leave the relationship, so she remained in it for over a year, living a habitual mire of resentment and anger the entire time. Justified or not in feeling those emotions, Candace watched her body pay the price. In November 2010, Candace finally saw a medical doctor who diagnosed her with Hashimoto's disease, also referred to as Hashimoto's thyroiditis, or chronic lymphocytic thyroiditis, an autoimmune disease in which the immune system attacks the thyroid gland. The condition is marked by hypothyroidism, an underactive thyroid with occasional bouts of hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid. Symptoms of Hashimoto's include weight gain, depression, mania, sensitivity to heat and cold, numbness, chronic fatigue, panic attacks, abnormal heart rate, high cholesterol, low blood sugar, constipation, migraines, muscle weakness, joint stiffness, cramps, memory loss, vision problems, infertility, and hair loss, many of which Candace was experiencing. During the consultation, the endocrinologist told Candace that her condition was genetic and she could do nothing about it. She would have Hashimoto's for the rest of her life and would need to take thyroid medication indefinitely, because her antibody count would never change. Although Candace discovered later that she actually had no family history of this illness, the die seemed cast. Having an actual diagnosis gave Candace the unexpected gift of awareness. She'd clearly needed a wake-up call, and this was it. The physical breakdown of her body had caused her to reflect on her past and really see the truth of who she was being. It dawned on her that she was single-handedly responsible for creating an autoimmune illness that was slowly destroying her physically, emotionally, and mentally. She was living a life in constant emergency fashion. All of her body's energy was going toward keeping her safe in an external environment, and no energy was left for her internal environment. Her immune system couldn't manage itself any longer. Despite the gut-wrenching fear of change and of the unfamiliar, Candace finally chose to leave the relationship 5 months later. She fully understood that the relationship had been unhealthy and not served her. She asked herself, "What's the trade-off? Stay in the dysfunction and propel myself deeper into darkness, or choose freedom and possibility? This is my chance for a new and different life." Candace's adversity became the genesis for her personal evolution, self-reflection, and expansion. She found herself standing on the edge of the cliff, wanting to leap into the unknown. Her decision to jump and to change became a passionate experience. So jump she did into what she saw as endless possibilities and potentials, compelled by a desire to finally stop doing what was no longer loving to her, so that she could rewrite her biological code. This was a turning point in Candace's life. She'd read my two previous books and been to one of my beginning workshops, so she knew that if she embraced her diagnosis and the emotions of fear, worry, anxiety, and sadness it inspired, she would be auto-suggesting and believing only in the thoughts equal to those feelings. She could try to think positively, but her body was feeling bad, so that would have real consequences. Making that choice would be the wrong placebo, the wrong state of being. So Candace chose instead not to accept her illness. She respectfully declined the physician's diagnosis, reminding herself that the mind that creates illness is the same mind that creates wellness. She knew she had to change her beliefs about the condition given to her by the medical community. Candace chose not to be suggestible to her doctor's advice and opinions because she wasn't fearful, victimized, or sad. In fact, she was optimistic and enthusiastic, and those emotions drove a new set of thoughts that allowed her to see a new possibility. She didn't accept her diagnosis, prognosis, or treatment. Believe hastily in the most probable outcome or future destiny, or permanently surrender to the diagnosis or treatment plan. She didn't condition her body to that future worst-case scenario, expect the same predictable outcome that everyone else did, or assign the same meaning that everyone else with the condition did. She had a different attitude, so she was now in a different state of being. Even though Candace didn't accept her condition, she had a lot of work ahead of her. She knew that to change her belief about her disease, she'd have to make a choice with an amplitude of energy that was greater than the hardwired programs in her brain and the emotional addictions in her body, so that her body could respond to a new mind. Only then could she experience the necessary change in energy that she needed to rewrite her subconscious programs and erase her past neurologically and genetically, which is exactly what began to happen. Although she had heard me say all of this before, and knew the material intellectually, Candace had never embraced the information from personal experience. In the first workshop she attended after getting the diagnosis, she looked exhausted and kept falling asleep in her chair. I knew she was struggling. When she came to her next workshop, she'd been taking thyroid medication to regulate her imbalanced chemical state for a little over a month, and she was more alert and interested. Candace was incredibly inspired by the stories I told during the weekend. When she heard that others weren't going to be victims of their circumstances in their external worlds, and that uncommon healings could happen, she decided that she was going to be her own science project. So Candace embarked on the journey. Having an understanding of epigenetics and neuroplasticity from my workshops, she knew she was no longer a victim of the disease, and instead used her knowledge to become proactive. She assigned a different meaning to her future, and so had a different intention. She awoke every day at 4:30 a.m. to do her meditation, and began to emotionally condition her body to a new mind. She worked on finding the present moment, which she realized had been lost to her before. Candace wanted to be happy and healthy, so she fought hard to regain her life. Even so, she struggled in the beginning and got very frustrated when she couldn't sit for any extended period of time. Her body had been trained to be the mind of frustration, anger, impatience, and victimization, and it understandably rebelled. As though she were training an undisciplined animal, Candace had to keep settling her body down to the present moment. Every time she went through that process, she was reconditioning her body to a new mind and freeing herself a bit more from the chains of her emotional addiction. Every day in her meditations, Candace worked on overcoming her body, her environment, and time. She refused to get up as the same person who sat down to do the meditation, because the old Candace was the one who became angry and frustrated and was so chemically addicted to her external circumstances. She didn't want to be that person anymore. She listened to her meditations, emulated a new state of being, and wouldn't stop until she was in love with life, in a true state of gratitude for no particular reason. Candace applied all the knowledge that she'd learned from my workshops and from listening to every audio CD, reading every book more than once, and studying her notes from the courses. She was wiring new information into her brain to prepare herself for a new experience of healing. More and more often, she found that she could refrain from firing and wiring the old neural connections of anger, frustration, resentment, arrogance, and mistrust, and that she could begin to fire and wire the new neural connections of love, joy, compassion, and kindness. In doing so, Candace knew she was pruning away the old connections and sprouting new ones. And the more time she made the effort with a level of mental fortitude, the more she would transform. In time, she became incredibly grateful to be alive, realizing that where harmony existed, incoherence couldn't abide. She told herself, "I am not the old Candace, and I am not reaffirming that existence any longer." For months on end, she persevered. And if she found herself being driven to that lowest common denominator, being angry or frustrated at the conditions in her external world, or feeling sick or unhappy, she would very quickly make a conscious shift. By swiftly changing her state of being, she could shorten the periods in which those emotions had a hold on her, so that she was overall less moody, less temperamental, and less like her old personality. Some days Candace felt so bad that she didn't want to get out of bed, but she got up anyway and meditated. She told herself that whenever she transmuted those lower emotions into elevated emotions, she was removing herself biologically from her past and priming her brain and body to a new future. She began to realize how worthwhile doing her inner work was, and it soon became less like effort and more like a gift. Thanks to her daily persistence, Candace noted a huge shift very quickly, and she started feeling better. She started communicating with others differently once she stopped looking at the world through a mind of fear and frustration, and instead looked through a lens of compassion, love, and gratitude. Her energy increased, and she was able to think more clearly. Candace realized that she didn't react the same way to the familiar conditions in her life, because the old, fear-based emotions were no longer within her body. She was overcoming her knee-jerk reactions, because she now saw that the people and conditions that used to upset her existed only in relation to how she was feeling. She was becoming free. Part of her process of change included becoming conscious of the unconscious thoughts that typically slipped by her awareness during the day. In her meditations, she became determined that those thoughts would never go unnoticed again. Under no circumstances would she allow herself to return to the behaviors and habits connected to her old self. She erased the chalkboard biologically, neurologically, and genetically, making room to create a new self, and her body began to liberate energy. In other words, she was going from particle to wave by releasing the stored emotions as energy in her body. Her body was no longer living the past. With this newly available energy that she'd freed up, Candace began to see the landscape of a new future. She asked herself, "How do I want to behave? How do I want to feel? How do I want to think?" By getting up every day for months on end in a state of gratitude, she was emotionally instructing her body that her new future had already arrived, which signaled new genes in new ways, moving her body back into homeostasis. Right on the other side of Candace's anger, she found compassion. Right on the other side of her frustration, she discovered patience and gratitude. And right on the other side of her victimization was a creator waiting to create joy and wellness. It was the same intense energy on either side, but she was now able to liberate it as she moved from particle to wave, from survival to creation. When Candace returned to her doctor 7 months after her diagnosis, he was amazed by the change in his patient. Her blood tests had come back perfect. In her initial round of tests in February 2011, her thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH, had been 3.61, which is high, and her antibody count had been 638, showing a major imbalance. But by September 2011, Candace's TSH had dropped to a normal 1.15, and her antibody count was a healthy 450, even though she was no longer taking any medication. She had healed herself in less than 1 year. The doctor wanted to know just what she'd been doing to get these great results. It seemed almost too good to be true. Candace explained that she knew she'd created this condition, so she decided to conduct an experiment on herself to uncreate it. She told the doctor that by meditating daily and maintaining an elevated state of emotion, she had been epigenetically signaling new genes instead of letting unhealthy emotions continue to signal the old genes. She explained that she'd worked regularly on who she wanted to become, and that she stopped responding to everything in her external environment like an animal in survival mode, fighting, fleeing, kicking, or screaming. Everything around her was basically the same. She was just responding in a way that was more loving to herself. The doctor told her, looking absolutely amazed, "I wish all my patients were like you, Candace. It's just incredible to hear your story." Candace doesn't really know how her healing happened. She doesn't need to. She just knows that she has become someone else. I had dinner with Candace a while after this happened, at a point when she had been off her medication for months and had no symptoms at all. Her health was fantastic. All her hair had grown back, and she felt great about herself. She mentioned over and over again that she was so in love with her present life. I told her, laughing, "You're in love with life, and it's loving you back. You should be in love with your life. You created it every day for months that way. Candace explained that she just trusted in an infinite field of potentials, that something else was going on beyond her that had helped her heal. All she really had to do was get beyond herself